And for years, not an award, not whether it be a Grammy, a Tony, or whatnot.
So even if you don't get the Oscar, there is some success, but there's still a huge problem in the whole studio system.
From top to bottom.
That was Spike Lee being interviewed by George Stephanopoulos on ABC. We were at Sundance. We interviewed Dawn Porter, the documentarian, Stanley Nelson. They're both supporting a boycott. Spike Lee's just not going. Mm-hmm. Your response to all of this?
There's a lot of wisdom in all of that. You know, this is personal. This is not, you know, a grand political statement. I appreciate not using the terminology boycott and going for the, listen, do you, I'm staying home. Just out of, you know, personal pride, I'm just going to stay home. I just don't have to stand for that. And I think he's, you know, exactly right. Because what he was pointing to when he was talking about, you know, being in the room with systemic issues. In other words, by the time you get to, and you know, you begin to see formulas across, you know, the whole, you know, the entire system in terms of racism. And one of the things is people shout and everybody gets upset by the time you get to the end result, which in this case is the Oscars. But what Spike is saying, it's like five other things that happened before that.
Acclaimed writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, to see part one of our conversation with the author of Between the World and Me, the National Book Award winner, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m., and coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Youth Summit, taking place February 12th and February 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club in Portland. February 12th will feature a workshop called Healing Ourselves to Raise Our Future, and a performance by spoken word artist S. Renee Mitchell. February 13th will feature workshops on topics ranging from becoming an MC to healthy living to information on going to Africa. That evening, the summit will close with a youth talent showcase. Again, that's the Portland Youth Summit, February 12th and 13th at the Blazers Boys and Girls Club, 5250 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
On Monday, February 15th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kboopc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon confirms its first case of Zika virus in 2016.
President Obama grants 1.8 million acres of scenic Southern California desert national monument status.
And the federal government proposes spending cuts to the cleanup operations at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 12, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The first case of Zika virus in Oregon this year has been reported. Oregon has had three previous cases of Zika since 2014, all of them travel-related. Demi Helenius of KBOO News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, has more.
Oregon's first case of Zika virus in 2016 was confirmed by the Oregon Health Authority on Wednesday. The new infection is travel-related, though the health authority will not say what country the individual visited. Before this year, three Oregonians were diagnosed with the virus in 2014 and 2015. In all three of those cases, individuals had traveled to Polynesia. Dr. Richmond Lehman of the Oregon Health Authority says the virus is primarily spread by the kind of mosquitoes found in tropical climates.
The likelihood of spread here in Oregon is very low. Just to be on the safe side, we don't want to find out the hard way that our mosquitoes, lo and behold, can carry Zika. And so we're just advising people who are ill with Zika to avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes while they're here in Oregon.
Public health officials in Oregon have been working with the CDC to test patients who have exhibited symptoms of the virus and traveled recently to countries where Zika is circulating. There are concerns Zika virus might cause a condition called microcephalia in the children of women infected early in pregnancy. Although there is no hard evidence a disease is linked to the condition, still, public health authorities are advising women who are pregnant or seeking to become pregnant to postpone travel to Zika-infected areas. In non-pregnant women, only around one-fifth of people infected develop symptoms, which include fever, aches, rash, and red eyes. Lehman says Zika is very mild compared to other viruses.
Fortunately for just average folks, it doesn't cause that severe disease. If you have a choice between getting Zika and getting influenza, you'd probably go with Zika in most cases.
If you must travel to Zika-infected areas, public health authorities advise to cover up and use insect repellent liberally. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
The armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon, ended yesterday with the surrender and arrest of the final four holdouts. It came after a bizarre night of live-streamed audio, which drew tens of thousands of listeners. Nell Abram, reporting with our friends at FreeSpeechRadioNews.org, has more.
41 days after it began, the takeover and ensuing standoff at Oregon's Malheur Wildlife Refuge came to a tense end Thursday with the surrender of the last four armed occupiers. The surrenders followed a bizarre evening in which more than 60,000 people listened through a live stream to Nevada Assemblywoman Michelle Fior talking to the occupiers over the phone while making her way by car from the Portland airport to Burns, Oregon, the closest town to the refuge. All the while, FBI negotiators outside their encampment tried to convince the four to peacefully leave.
The rest of the American people want to hear your story. Come on out.
They're hearing it. They know it. They're going to know it. Tomorrow, when they wake up and they find out that you killed us, revolution, I guarantee it.
And then you're going to hell.
The tone of the conversation was alternately rational and fear-fueled. But finally, a plan was hatched, and Fior agreed to be present at the time of surrender. Thursday morning, three of the four holdouts left their camp at the refuge peacefully, holding U.S. flags aloft. Sean and Sandy Anderson of Idaho and Jeff Banta from Nevada. But the fourth, David Fry, stayed back in what became a tense and potentially suicidal situation.
This is where you come to a point in life where it's liberty or death. I will not be forced to pay for my existence through health insurance or having to pay for abortion, having to pay to murder millions over in the Middle East. I will not tolerate that. Americans have become radical in themselves, being all anti-Muslim and everything, but they don't even know their own book. The Muslim book says Christians, Jewish, Muslims, believers all go to heaven if they follow their own book. That's what the Muslim Quran says. And you guys think they hate you.
After about an hour of negotiations with the FBI and scripture-filled conversation with supporters, much of which, again, was carried on livestream, David Fry emerged with hands up. The standoff began in early January when an armed group seized control of the public park, ostensibly in defense of a couple of local ranchers sentenced to a mandatory minimum prison term for arson on protected public land. Among the leaders of the armed group were members of the Bundy family, who garnered national attention for an armed standoff with federal agents in 2014 in Nevada. Two of the Bundy brothers are now facing charges related to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge takeover. Family patriarch Cliven Bundy, was taken into custody Wednesday night after he landed at Portland's International Airport. One person died as a result of the siege, shot by police during a traffic stop. At least 16 people are now facing charges in connection with the armed takeover. The last four will be arraigned Friday. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
President Obama granted national monument status today to nearly 1.8 million acres of scenic Southern California desert. In California this week, Obama signed proclamations establishing three regions as national monuments, Mojave Trails and Castle Mountains, both in the Mojave Desert, and Sand to Snow in the Sonoran Desert. The White House says the move will maintain in perpetuity the region's fragile ecosystem and natural resources, as well as provide recreational opportunities for hikers, campers, hunters, and others. The areas hold numerous important Native American archaeological sites, an estimated 1,700 Native American petroglyphs, as well as golden eagles, bighorn sheep, mountain lions, hundreds of species of birds, and 12 endangered or threatened species of wildlife. The designations will also connect those regions to other protected government land, including Joshua Tree National Park, the Mojave National Preserve, and 15 other federal wilderness areas. The designations will nearly double the amount of public land that Obama has designated as national monument status since taking office. The Federal Antiquities Act, adopted in 1906, grants the president the authority to protect landmarks, structures, and objects of historic or scientific interest by designating them as national monuments.
The White House has proposed spending less on cleaning up defense sites next year, including the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State. Hanford is the largest environmental cleanup site on Earth, made famous for producing the plutonium used for the atomic bomb detonated over Nagasaki, Japan during World War II. The administration proposed a 19.2% reduction in money allotted to Washington's Richland Operations Office, which is responsible for groundwater cleanup. Hanford's groundwater is extensively contaminated by the disposal of more than 440 billion gallons of contaminated liquids. Although liquid waste disposal stopped at Hanford in 1997, contaminated groundwater still sits underground in cracks in the soil, slowly moving through layers of sand and soil. The contaminated water will eventually flow into the Columbia River if not contained. Washington state officials were quick to denounce the decision. They called the proposed Hanford budget inadequate and short-sighted, and they said it would result in cleanup delays. Washington state representative Dan Newhouse voiced concerns. He said the proposed reduction in funding violates the federal government's legal and moral obligation to clean up Hanford.
The water in Flint, Michigan has been switched back to its older, cleaner municipal source, but local residents are still struggling to get their pipes cleaned up. Rebecca Williams from the Environment Report has more.
Little pieces of lead causing really high test results in Flint. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams. It's been almost 4 months since Flint went back to buying water from Detroit's system. And here's the good news. Since January, more than 90% of water tests have come back below the federal action level for lead. But there are still some insanely high lead levels in some homes. Take a look at a map of where those are, and there's just no pattern.
So it becomes almost a Russian roulette type thing.
That's Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech researcher who's now working with the state to help resolve Flint's water crisis.
You might have samples that you collected from your house that were zero. And you would be wrong to think you're protected from lead in water because you previously tested at zero. Because until corrosion control is effective, there's a chance a piece of this lead will fall into your water.
So what's going on here? Remember, the protective coating inside of pipes has been eaten away throughout the city because the water wasn't treated properly. What that means is that little pieces of lead are flaking off pipes throughout the system. And if one of those pieces makes its way to your house, you could wind up with a situation like Lila Lovelace. Lindsay Smith stopped by to see her because a water sample from her house came back really high.
A couple of weeks ago, Lovelace was picking up a case of bottled water at one of the fire stations in Flint. They had free water tests, too, so she picked one up. And it's a good thing she did. Her water test came back with more than 6,000 parts per billion of lead.
Yeah, told me don't bathe in it, which I wouldn't anyway.
Any lead level above 5,000 parts per billion, the U.S. EPA considers hazardous waste. Luckily, Lovelace hasn't been drinking the water. She takes a shower at one of her daughter's houses twice a week.
And here I get the bottle of water and put it in the bucket and wash up here.
Lots of people in Flint have been testing their water recently. Lovelace's lead test is one of the worst to come back so far this year. So a team of people from the EPA paid her a visit yesterday to test her water.
Hello. Hello. Hey, how's everybody?
Good, how are you?
Miss Lovelace?
Yeah. Two women from the EPA lug a large blue cooler into Lovelace's kitchen. They're here to take a bunch of samples to give them a better idea of where the lead is coming from. In the meantime, Megan Hemkin, who's with the EPA, shows Lovelace how to clean out the aerators on her faucets. This is where these lead flakes can get caught.
And so what we're asking residents to do is to take off their filters or the aerators on their faucets about once a week and just to get all of this stuff out.
Okay, take this part off.
Yep, so take this part off like this. Okay.
This issue with lead flakes is something Mark Durno talked about with me. He's the on-scene coordinator with the EPA in Flint. He says they think these little particles are what's causing these high lead levels in some homes. And he says it can happen anywhere at any time.
One of the things that we're strongly advising of homeowners is anything that can trap particles, flush it routinely, especially during this emergency phase.
So that means cleaning those aerators. And if you have a whole house filter, taking that out and cleaning it off. And he says people should run their water first thing in the morning for 5 to 10 minutes.
The good news is the EPA and other experts say the water filters do work to remove lead, even at these higher levels. You've got to make sure the filter is NSF certified. But out of an abundance of caution, the EPA is still saying for pregnant women and kids under 6, it's safest to drink bottled water right now.
Thanks, Lindsay.
No problem.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Portland's weather tonight, a 60% chance of showers with a low of 45. A 50 to 80% chance of showers tomorrow with a high of 52. And continued rain tomorrow night with a low of 48. Today in history, in 1924, Calvin Coolidge became the first U.S. president to deliver an address by radio. This was also the first day that radio programming included commercials. The National Carbon Company aired an advertisement during the broadcast of the Everyday Hour. This show featured celebrity appearances, music, and stories. The quote of the day is from Johnny Carson. He said, "If it weren't for Philo T. Farnsworth, inventor of television, we'd still be eating frozen radio dinners."
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Imagine the outcry by Tea Party Republicans if state legislators were passing laws banning the use of video cameras and banks to capture images of robbers. Yet, those very same Tea Partiers have been passing laws in various states to ban the use of videos to capture images of such giant factory farm operators as Tyson that are engaged in inhumane, immoral, and disgusting abuses of turkeys, hogs, and other animals. The only reason the public knows about chickens being stomped to death and pregnant sows being driven insane because they're caged so tightly that they can't even turn around is because courageous whistleblowers have secretly taped videos of the intolerable violence inside these animal concentration camps. In response to the videoed exposés, however, 8 states run by shameless, corporate-hugging Republicans have rushed to protect the worst abusers, making it illegal to release such tapes to the media or the public. North Carolina's corrupt legislature, for example, has decreed that videoers who cause bad publicity for corporate animal torturers can be sued by the corporation and fined $5,000 for each day abuses are recorded. To add to the Kafkaesque absurdity of this ag-gag law, the state legislature's corporate butt-kissers mandated that releasing videos of abuses in nursing home chains, daycare centers, and veterans facilities is now also banned. This is Jim Hightower saying, in their eagerness to please corporate lobbyists and get campaign donations from these grossly abusive profiteers, Tea Party Republicans across the country are stomping on our constitutional rights to free speech and freedom of the press, just as mindlessly as the animal abusers stomp chickens to death. For information and action tips on stopping this disgrace, go to aspca.org/openthebarns.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has asked the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to consider the role legal marijuana could play in the prescription opioid epidemic. In a letter to the CDC, the senator asked for more research into medical marijuana and painkiller addiction. According to the CDC, the use of prescription opioids doubled between 2000 and 2014. However, in the 13 states that passed laws allowing for the use of medical marijuana between 1999 and 2010, 25% fewer people die from opioid overdoses annually. Oregon passed the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act by voter approval in 1998. It allowed the use of marijuana by doctor recommendation for patients with certain medical conditions. Despite this, between 2000 and 2012, more than 4,000 people died due to unintentional and undetermined drug overdose in Oregon, according to a 2014 report from the Oregon Health Authority. That's an average of 320 overdose deaths per year. Oregon also saw its rate of fatal heroin overdoses more than triple between 2000 and 2012. Senator Warren called on the CDC to consider the role of marijuana legalization in the overdose crisis, specifically requesting the agency to provide more information on the use, uptake, and effectiveness of medical marijuana as an alternative to opioids for pain treatment in states where it's legal.
The family of a child shot dead by Cleveland police in 2014 was billed this week $500 for ambulance services by city officials. But the mayor of Cleveland formally apologized yesterday to Tamir Rice's survivors for filing a claim in probate court demanding the money. The filing came after the administrator for Rice's estate filed a request for city documents relating to the shooting. Rice's administrator Douglas Winston told the Associated Press yesterday he had never seen such a request result in a claim being filed in probate court, which Cleveland officials did Wednesday. Cleveland Mayor Frank Johnson says the process is routine, but under the circumstances of the 12-year-old's shooting death at the hands of a rookie police officer, should have been flagged and deleted from the system. Rice was fatally shot almost 2 years ago by Officer Timothy Lowen while playing with a plastic toy gun outside a city recreation center. Police officials said Lowen and his training officer were responding to a 911 call about a, quote, man waving a gun at people, end quote. A grand jury in late December declined to indict either of the officers on criminal charges. Mayor Jackson previously apologized to Rice's family in March of 2015 when city attorneys blamed Rice for his own death.
Sunday is Valentine's Day, and many mark the occasion with romantic clichés and gifts of chocolate. But in India, women's rights groups are using the holiday to campaign against gender-based violence under the banner One Billion Rising. According to India's National Crime Records Bureau, rape is the fourth most common crime against women. In 2012, several rape cases in India received widespread international attention and prompted the country to reform its penal code for sex crimes. But critics say the prosecution process is still slow and allows too many rapists to go uncharged. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal reports from the western Indian city of Jaipur.
Hundreds of women, children and activists gathered at Gaurav Towers, a central meeting place for young people in the city, where they watched a street play performed by the Asmita Theatre Group demanding women's rights in the country. The young artists call on the men present at the venue to stop violence against women. Shilpi Marwa, a noted Indian film actress and an activist, plays the lead role.
It's going extremely well over here. I have been performing a street play that is based against atrocities in women in public areas. It's been a very positive response we have been getting from different places. Women are coming out discussing their problems in open.
According to the United Nations, one in every three women across the globe is beaten or raped during her lifetime. In India, crime record data reveals that two women are raped in the country every hour. After the 2012 brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old woman while aboard a bus gained global attention, lawmakers in India passed several new laws and created six new fast-track courts to hear rape cases. But this only increased the number of women willing to file cases against their alleged rapists. The country's legal system remains slow to hear and prosecute the culprits, and rape remains an hourly occurrence. Last week, a 15-year-old girl in Jamshedpur city reported being sexually assaulted while in the hospital. She had been admitted just days before following her rape. Another survivor, Dalit activist Bhavani Devi, has been seeking justice since she was gang raped in 1992.
I will not stop fighting for justice in my entire life. Even if I get old and my body parts don't work properly, then I will still keep struggling.
After five different judges were removed from the case, a sixth found the men accused of raping Bhavri not guilty. After much pressure was brought to bear, the state appealed the acquittal. The Rajasthan High Court case, filed in 1994, is still pending. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Jaipur, India.
South African social activist Desmond Tutu is asking why it has taken prosecutors so long to charge four apartheid-era police believed to be behind the murder of a young female activist 32 years ago. Nokutule Simelane was abducted and held captive by security police in Johannesburg in September 1983. She disappeared and her remains were never found. Just this week, South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority announced it would charge the men who are linked to the disappearance of the 23-year-old. Strong evidence suggests Simelane was brutally tortured and murdered, and her family says the four officers chose to put the family through years of trauma instead of telling the truth at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Tutu welcomed the decision, saying he hoped it marked a turning point for the prosecuting authority, which he said has only pursued less than a handful of more than 300 apartheid-era cases recommended for legal action in 2002. The four suspects will face trial later this month. Listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emmy Kunze, Demi Hellenius, Lisa Loving, and David Kesters. The producer is David Kesters, and our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, guest host Doug McVeigh speaks with Courtney Moran, a local attorney who heads up the Oregon Hemp Industry Association. They'll talk about the current state of the international hemp industry and the prospects for hemp in the United States. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with environmental writer Jimmy Tobias about the Crusaders in Suits, the senators, oil lobbyists, and right-wing legislators who are the real threat to America's public lands. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Kristen Yount continues her coverage on the Portland Harbor Superfund site and the various remediation plans being considered by the EPA. And at 11:30, we speak with reporter Daniel Forbes. His recent article in the Portland Mercury on glass factories in Portland and the high levels of cadmium in nearby neighborhoods. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. And have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.